From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We have been conducting a series of interviews with candidates who are appearing on your ballots, and we are bringing the candidates to you at length so you can hear about them, their positions, their priorities for office. And two candidates this hour, dividing the hour into. In our second half hour, we'll talk to a candidate for New York State Senate, Scott Comegys, running in District number 54. In our first half hour, we welcome a candidate in Assembly District number 137. That's most of the city of Rochester and the town of Gates. Damon Meeks has been a member of the New York State Assembly running for re-election. He is back with us now. Assemblymember, thank you for making the time for us.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
The website for Damon Meeks, it's votedamonmeeks.com. His opponent in this race, Marcus Williams, will be on this program, I think, in about a week. Is that right, producer Megan Mack? And Marcus, in about a week. Yeah, something like that. So I want to thank you for being here, and I want to start by asking you what we always ask guests here. You're pretty well known now, but there's still listeners, even in your district, who don't know much about you. Tell us a little bit about yourself and why you want to run for re-election for this.
I'm a little bit about myself. I'm Damon Meeks, born and raised here in the city of Rochester. Have a background in grassroots community organizing. 10 years before, for 10 years before running for office, I was a labor organizer with 1199 SEIU. My background is one who subscribes to servant leadership opposed to politician, and I've been committed to this community doing work before deciding to run for office that I have always been intentional in uplifting the community in which I serve. And that continues to be my heart, and that continues to be my practice. I've been blessed to be positioned around individuals who believe in holding me accountable, whether it's the wife that I sleep with every night or just members of the community that I have ties to. And that means a lot, you know, because it's not just operating in the manner that, you know, you may find yourself operating, but also having those accountability partners in order to do this work collectively.
You've served how many terms now?
Two full terms.
You're looking for term number three.
Yes.
Tell listeners, in roughly 4 years working in Albany, when you think about what has been done, what's on the resume that you say, I'm really proud of this, I'm glad we worked on this, I can point to this. What's at the top of the list for you?
I would say there's a number of things at the top of the list, you know, whether it's programs such as Fair Access to Victims Compensation, like making sure that those who are victims of violence, victims of crime, are able to tap into the resources that the state offer. A clean slate, giving individuals who historically had a criminal charge, such as a felony or a misdemeanor, a second chance at life. Removing barriers to employment, removing barriers to quality housing. I think that's major. And then also the deliverables in the community for some of the long established programs that have been beneficial to communities for decades, such as Baden Street, being able to deliver resources such as $8.1 million and resources for some major needed capital projects there in the northeast part of the community.
What is it's not priority one. I mean, you've got a lot of priorities because you're in office now, but what are the issues that you look at and say, if I'm reelected, the most pressing that we are working on right now is what?
There's some major pressing things. I mean, we made some strides as it relates to housing. We passed good cause eviction at the state level of government. However, there's things that need to take place locally in regards to that legislation. When we look at the need for quality, access to quality and affordable housing, that's a major challenge that we need to continue to do more work in that space. And also education. You know, when we look at challenges with education in our communities, we committed with the governor to increase funding for reading and reading comprehension programs to look and see that there's been like generations of kids that don't have the ability to read. When you look at school systems and different practices, such as going away from teaching children to read phonetically, helping them to understand that every letter of the alphabet makes its own sound, if not multiple sounds. The practice of sounding out words, which is how many of us learned how to read over the years. And I think challenges with our school system and making sure that, The students have the resources that they need. The teachers in that space have the resources that they need. And collectively, as a community, active parent engagement in that space.
That's really interesting that you bring this up, because it shows, at least it indicates to me, how much publicity, how much sunlight has been brought to this issue of literacy and why we've got kids struggling. By the way, kids are struggling to read in every district in the country if they are not brought up with the skills that the Assemblyman just talked about. We've seen all kinds of data and research for decades on this now, but a lot of districts have been slow to move off this. And so it becomes an equity issue, because if you're a well-to-do family and you've got a nine-year-old who is struggling to read, you're probably hiring a tutor. You're hiring outside help. And then you think, well, things are fine. If you don't have those resources, your child may not be reading by third grade, fifth grade, sixth grade, and now are in real trouble for the rest of their lives, right?
Absolutely. And looking at our educational systems, one of the things that I've advocated for and will continue to advocate for is expanding CTE programs, career technology education. When we look at our community, you know, the eastern suburbs, you have BOCES East, the western suburbs, you have BOCES West. However, as it relates to the city, we don't have that expanse of a BOCES program. We have some great programs over at schools such as Edison Tech, and other schools may offer a few vocational programs. But I think that we have to be intentional in connecting our students to skill sets and ability that once they graduate high school, whether they go to college or not, they'll be able to fend for themselves as well as their families. And I think that's something that we really need to lift in our Big Five school districts.
We're talking to Damon Meeks, running for re-election to the New York State Assembly. Earlier this year, New York State helped secure $750,000 for the Rochester Minow Anti-Poverty Initiative. Were you part of helping secure that funding?
Yes.
Okay. I want to ask, because RMAPI is going to be turning 10, I think, over the next year. They're in their 10th year. And in their early days, they set really ambitious poverty reduction goals, which at this point are not going to be attained. Leonard Brock was the CEO right out of the gate, and he said in 15 years, we want to see a 50% reduction in poverty in Rochester.
Yeah.
And there's just no indication that we're going to be close. Poverty has had a very small incremental decline in roughly 10 years, but Rochester remains one of the top five poorest cities in the country, if cities of its size. So take me through why you said you look at this, and I'm not trying to denigrate RMAPI. I think there's people who are absolutely doing everything they can think of. But what are the standards where you say, this is working? Let's invest more in this. This is effective. Take me through that.
I mean, you do have to look at data, right, and see how things are moving. More often than not, I mean, it's similar to having a mission statement of sorts, setting ambitious goals and planning to reach those goals. And I just think that it really takes a collective. It's, you know, when we see major strides in this community, it's not simply a not-for-profit or a private sector. It's often collectively bringing the different entities together, whether it's government, private sector, not-for-profit sector, and really been intentional in moving things ahead as a community. So I think that there's a lot of work to be done in this space. I'm one who often say we have to push hope with opportunities. So when we look at the challenges of poverty, what do they stem from? And there's a plethora of different challenges, and many of them are systemic.
Right now, are you confident that we're moving in a positive direction dealing with poverty?
I think we're making some movement, but there's a lot more work to be done. You know, when we advocate for resources from the state, we've seen, I mean, in my short time here, I mean, we've been able to bring, you know, billions of dollars to this community. And, you know, millions or tens of millions on one project at a time. And one of the things that we've been pushing for is going beyond just saying, hey, we've been able to bring these resources, but what's happening with these resources? It's one thing to have a major capital project in the heart of the city, and you see a number of white men from surrounding areas that come in and do the work. And I'm really pushing that, hey, we need to make sure that individuals on the other side of the tracks have an opportunity to generate wealth from these projects. So to bring a new housing development is one thing, but to allow individuals from that community to generate wealth by building on that project and learning a different skill set and doing that work, that's the direction we must go into to really push back against poverty.
Let me talk to you a little bit more about housing. I know that's a big part of your work. At the top of the presidential ticket for the Democrats, both the presidential and the vice presidential candidates have touted a goal of building 3 million additional houses in this country in the next 4 years. At the Democratic National Convention, former President Barack Obama said that in many ways, mostly Democratic-run cities have made a mistake of making it too difficult to build new housing. Housing is an issue at every level of government. It's often a local issue. I do wonder what you think the state's role is, and do you think it needs to be easier to get new housing built?
I think as a city, Rochester's been doing pretty good. You have an executive in Mayor Malik Evans that has worked with, you know, government, with state government, as it relates to building houses. However, there's been some pushback in a number of our surrounding suburbs as it relates to building new housing in those developments, in those towns, in those townships. So I think that some of our cities, depending on your leadership, have been on board and been able to make some strides in this space, but it goes beyond the land of the city. We also need our suburban counterparts to also commit to these efforts. You know, something I saw the other night was a statement made by one of the candidates for vice president that the challenge with our housing stock is migrant populations coming
JD
in.
Vance said that.
And I was absolutely disgusted, you know, by that statement. When we look at us as a community here in Rochester, you have a number of investors. Many of them don't live here. You know, to have investors from London, from China, other countries, they don't live in this community, but they've made investments here. And some of them are slumlords. And I think there needs to be a different rule of engagement for those type of landlords as well.
Talking to Damon Meeks, he's running for New York State Assembly. It's votedamonmeeks.com for a website for the candidate. I want to talk to you about public safety as well. And a couple of issues that you have worked on. Let's make sure we put a fine point on these issues, and then I want to talk more broadly about public safety. But the Clean Slate Act. Tell me about the Clean Slate Act.
So I touched on that before. With Clean Slate, it gives individuals who historically had a felony or misdemeanor in specific crimes an opportunity at a second chance at life, per se. So, for instance, if it's a specific type of felony, after 8 years, it's expunged as it relates to public view. However, the courts still have access to that information. If it's a misdemeanor, it's after 3 years. It gives individuals an opportunity to apply for employment opportunities, housing opportunities, without continuing to carry that dark cloud over them.
And your opponent in this race has continued to say that bail reform was a mistake. I know that for years now, there's been this ongoing debate about what it actually does. Where do you stand on whether you want to see any more changes to the bail system? And if these changes over the last however many years have been as effective as you had hoped?
So when you look at the changes, you know, bail reform was passed in 2019. I often say this to my colleagues. I've never seen the Republicans pass legislation and spend the next 5 or 6 years defending that legislation. It just doesn't happen. I've never seen it happen before. Since I've been in office, all we've seen was one thing after the next rescinded as it relates to bail reform. And it's to the point now where you do have a number of people in this community calling for dangerousness standard. Well, if you ask them what their definition of dangerousness standard is, it already exists in New York State. It already exists in New York State by way of the rollout of the changes to bail reform.
Dangerous is typically referred to as a judicial discretion issue, right?
Absolutely. And the judges have discretion in this space as it relates to bail reform. So there's a number of things that have been rescinded. We've had real talks and conversations with members of law enforcement, and that's how we move forward. So it wasn't just, you know, elected officials saying, oh, well, this is what we think. No, we had conversation with those who did research in this space, and we also had conversations with those in law enforcement. And what I find with bail reform, it goes back to my mindset, for instance, is I cannot continue to spend so much time and energy on winning the argument. I have to be intentional and focus on solving the problems. And what we find with bail reform is you have the same old people in an attempt to win an argument when the requests that were made by members of law enforcement have been met.
Well, so let's close that loop with law enforcement. It is not true that every single chief of police or every single sheriff feels the same about bail reform, but there have been some serious criticism from the Monroe County Sheriff's Office, for example. I don't know where RPD is. I mean, have you had conversations with Chief Smith or RPD about bail reform?
No, it's interesting that you don't see Chief Smith standing with this consortium of sorts with Sheriff Ty Baxter. So I haven't had a personal conversation
so
with him.
He hasn't called your office to say this is a problem.
He has not.
Okay.
No.
Whereas some sheriffs, Sheriff Baxter has been critical. He has said that he understands the need or the original intention of the changes. But the impression left in New Yorkers' minds is that we have this set of laws where if you are arrested and suspected of committing a violent crime, that there's just no way to do anything but just let you go free for days or weeks or months on end.
Yeah, I almost said a curse word. We can't curse on air, right? So with that, you know, the reality of it is bail reform is it's a cashless bond system for nonviolent crimes. Even so much so, we made a gun with no bullets a Class E felony, right, which makes it bail eligible. So what we often see is you'll see some folks in this community, some members in media saying things such as, oh, this person was caught shooting a gun on this date and this time, and then they were released. Oh, bail reform is the problem. Well, if they were released, that did not pertain to bail reform. It may pertain to their family being able and having the resources to post the bail for the individual and them being released. But as it relates to bail reform, a cashless bond system for nonviolent crimes, it does not fall up under that.
All right, let's turn a little bit about health care here. We don't have single-payer health care in this state. And depending on sort of who you are and your circumstances, you might think that we've got the best health care system in the world. You might think that it's often unattainable or that a lot of people only have catastrophic care coverage and or don't have coverage at all. What is the status of healthcare in your district, and what would you like to see change?
Oh, wow. I mean, we recognize some challenges, even so much so this past session we passed legislation to make it where individuals in New York State who have healthcare who are dependent on insulin will no longer have to pay a copayment for their insulin. If we could have universal health care, I mean, if I could wave a magic wand and make sure everybody have quality health care, I would do it in a heartbeat, you know, because it would mean that we would have a much healthier community, a healthier society of sorts. And, you know, my background as a labor organizer, I used to see it all too often where we would have some facilities where individuals didn't have the best health care coverage or weren't making the best wages. So they could not afford to be sick. So to see someone who comes to work and you can see it in their eyes, you can see it in their face that they're ill. However, I cannot afford to be sick. And I think that's a major challenge when we look at healthcare system as well as wages.
What can be done?
I think more advocacy, getting people, getting everyday people to have a voice in this space and to say to members of government, this is what we need and this is what we're demanding as a people. I just think over the years hearing different arguments such as, oh, well, the unions have this and we don't have that. Why should they have it? And I think the mindset should be that a number of the strides that we have made in the labor force, even as it relates to a 40-hour work week, as it relates to youth workers, these things came about by way of labor fights, labor struggles, the benefits that everyone tend to have on a job, such as some vacation pay and some sick time. I think that we should have the mindset that these are the things that unions have fought for and they've obtained, and this is what we deserve as workers across the board throughout the United States.
Let me grab a phone call. Frank has been wanting to weigh in on the subject of housing. Hi, Frank. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. I just wanted to say that I keep hearing about building more housing. I live in the town of Greece, and I know for a fact, because I've been shopping for housing, that in the Dewey Stone neighborhood of Greece, not too far from Charlotte, quite frankly, Mr. Dawson, that you can buy a house for maybe $1,300 a month for with a PITI mortgage. And perhaps we need more banking reform. Perhaps we need more credit reform. But we certainly don't need more buildings. We have plenty of buildings in the town of Greece. You can get yourself a good, solid, small, clean house in the Dewey Stone neighborhood of Rochester for about $110,000. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Frank. Assembly member, what do you think?
I think that's a valid point. You know, one of the things I look at, and speaking of potential reforms as it relates to lending practices, when you see and know people personally and have family members that have rented housing for years, that were able to pay their rent on time, you know, paying, you know, $800+ a month for 15 to 20 years. And if they had a mortgage, they could have paid that. However, there's other factors that come into play, such as, you know, their credit score and one's ability to pay and their track record and their payment history, whether they're paying things on time, so on and so forth. So I think that that type of reform in our banking systems is needed. And I think that's also why you have, you know, members of state government having conversations about community banking as well.
Before I let you go, since I've got about 2 minutes left, I want to ask you a question that's a little bit offbeat, but I just want to kind of get your thoughts on this. We see in this current election, and there's a lot of polling that gets done when there's a presidential election because more people will vote, people are a little bit more engaged. I personally think people should be engaged in every single election at every level, as I'm sure Assembly member does, as I'm sure your opponent does. But the reality is we're in a presidential cycle, so a lot of people are engaged right now.
Yes.
And what we see in polling, it's true at the presidential race, but it's true really across races this year. There's a big gender gap. Women are more likely to vote blue. Men are more likely to vote red. And, you know, it goes by different ages at times or whatever, but mostly, it's the biggest gender gap we've seen in voting, maybe ever. And I wonder if you have any insight as to why we're seeing that.
You know, I don't really have any insight per se. I just think that we as a country, we as a community, are all too often plagued by the isms. You know, whether it's racism, sexism, ageism, the list goes on and on. I remember years ago being in Erie, Pennsylvania, working on Hillary Clinton's campaign and, you know, talking to a number of middle-aged white women who said, hey, I'm not voting for her because I don't believe that, you know, politics is a place for women. And, you know, you have these different ideologies. And I think some of it stems from experiences and how people are reared up or trained up, per se, opposed to realizing that we live in a different day and time. You know, my first CEO was mom. You know, mom made sure that the bills got paid. Mom made sure that, you know, we were where we were supposed to be at and made sure that she set goals in place for us and we were able to achieve them. And, you know, I recognize that the vice president, Kamala Harris, is in a great position to become the president of the United States and will do an awesome job at that position. One thing I don't agree with is you hearing people say things such as, well, she was a prosecutor and she locked these people up and members of our community. And I think that, you know, since when we are judged for doing our job at the best of our ability, she was a prosecutor. So prosecutors are called to take individuals to trial and win those trials. And I just think that, you know, it tends to be one rule of engagement for some and a different rule of engagement for others.
You're comfortable with her record as a prosecutor?
I'm comfortable with advocating for Kamala Harris as the next president of the United States of America. Sometimes when you look at careers and track records, you can also learn from them. So if you're not happy with what took place at a certain time, where did you grow in that space and what did you learn from it? So I'm not saying that, you know, I'd support her record 110%.
Every little thing she did, yeah.
But I am saying that you can learn from your experience and grow and be better in that space. One other thing I wanted to touch on as it relates to crime in the community.
Yep.
There are things that we are working on collectively as state representatives with local members of government, our mayor, our county executive. And when we look at challenges with car thefts, I want to state on the record that car thefts as of September are down 61%. It's tough to talk about
year over year, I think.
Yeah, from last year. Yep. Yes. And part of that is based upon implementing programs. One of those awesome programs is the JEDS program, which is a Juvenile Enhanced Diversion Stabilization Program. And this program, even before a child is charged with something, getting a commitment from the courts, working with the parent, working with the probation system, basically putting them on a system sort of like a child in need of supervision. So in some instances, they give them GPS monitors, they set curfew standards, they set standards for those individuals to attend school on a regular basis. And with that, the recidivism rate of car theft with this program is 1%. So it's tough when you recognize that, yeah, we just lost a member in our community to a car to death. We lost a member in our community following a car chase,
yep.
Right? And that's worst case scenarios. But as it relates to recognizing challenges and being intentional and implementing programs that we know work, we're doing that. And I think that those things need to be spoke about as well.
Thank you for making time for the program today.
Yes, thank you.
Damon Meeks is running for re-election in New York State Assembly District number 137. His opponent will be on this program next week. His website, votedamonmeeks.com.